It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today we talk with a grand dame of the San Francisco food scene, Cecilia Chang. She didn't know she was a visionary when she opened a little Chinese restaurant in San Francisco back in 1961. Cecilia was in the wrong neighborhood with a kind of Chinese food no one had ever tasted. And the story gets only better. You know all the intricacies of tasting wine? Well, chocolate's stepping into that arena. Baking pro Dory Greenspan has had lessons in tasting the good stuff. Tea expert Bill Waddington brings us a kind of tea that we've never had access to before. The teas that tea families grow for themselves. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get going with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, I don't know if the name of this restaurant we're about to recommend is Feigs or Feigs. It's F-E-I-G-S, but it is an extremely unlikely restaurant in Tucson, Arizona, where perhaps the last thing one might expect to find is a kosher deli. But that's what Feigs is.
Or Feigs.
Or Feigs.
So what do they, maybe you would explain for people who don't know what a kosher deli is, what we're
talking
about.
Well, a kosher deli means it goes by the kashrut rules, which is there is no cheese, no dairy product whatsoever in this place. You can get great smoked fish. There's all kinds of meat, pastrami, corned beef, and so forth, but absolutely no dairy. And of course, needless to say, no pork.
They have a short menu. You can get chicken in a pot, stuffed cabbage rolls, gefilte fish, chopped liver, matzo ball soup, and knishes. I mean, it's probably a place that people who are from the Northeast or from New York City who winter in Tucson, Arizona, must have demanded.
One of the things that's great about Feigs or Feigs, I'll just say Feigs, okay?
Okay.
One of the things that's great about it is they bake their own bread. So their bagels, I mean, it's very, you're going to get bagels like hot from the oven. And the bialys are excellent too. I mean, you know, the bialy is similar to a bagel, but chewier with a little onion in the middle of it.
Yeah, yeah. And when
and
you
those
butter
are great.
That, well, you can't butter it there, but, you know, cream, well, you can't do cream cheese.
No, alas.
Anything on a bialy is going to be good.
Exactly. And for the sandwiches, you get your choice of rye bread, pumpernickel bread, or a marble rye, which is a combination of the two sort of swirled together. And if you don't specify, your sandwich comes on the marble rye, which is a really kind of, it's interesting looking. I don't taste the flavor difference between the two, but it's interesting looking, and it is a good, solid kind of kosher bread.
Are these those sandwiches, very typical deli sandwiches, where the bread is a token gesture and, the, you know, there's 3 inches of sliced meat on them?
I would say it's a mere 2 inches. You can actually pick up a half of one of these sandwiches in one or preferably two hands and eat it. You know, it's kind of ridiculously overstuffed, but not so much that you can't eat it with your hands like a regular sandwich.
To me, for a great kosher deli, there are 3 tests. And one is the half-cured pickles.
Mm-hmm.
The other is the chicken liver. And then the third is, if they do, stuffed cabbage. The quality of the stuffed cabbage. I may be completely off base, but how do they rank?
The half sour pickle is great. I mean, it's really, it's just what you would want. You just get a piece of a pickle on your plate. And what I love is the kind of deli where you get a little bowl of pickles and pickled tomatoes and stuff.
And you
don't
get
that
here. The entire thing before the sandwich comes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, but
yeah.
The pickle is good. The stuffed cabbage roll is excellent. I mean, it's like real homey, you know, and it's like, you know, the stuffing is kind of very aromatic. That's what I would say.
And I give the chopped liver on a scale of 10, maybe a 6.5. But you have to understand that, you know, if it isn't Barney Greengrass, the Sturgeon King on Amsterdam Avenue in New York, it isn't even on my radar screen. But it's good. It's, you know, it's
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
have to say that, you know, I would add to your list or maybe even substitute one of the things on your list, corned beef. For me, either corned beef or pastrami is the true test of a deli. And the corned beef at Feigs is really good. It's, you know, warm, juicy. It's tender. It's not too highly spiced. spice is kind of mildly spicy, you really remember as you eat this that it began as brisket before it got spiced.
By the way, I admit that my list is quixotic. Ignoring deli meats is a little bit absurd, but that's
insane.
I understand. It's very kind of you not to tell me I'm nuts. But this place sounds really great. What does it look like?
It's actually a grocery store, and you know, most of it is devoted to shelves of, you know, matzah and canned gefilte fish and stuff like that. But if you walk through past all the groceries, there is a counter in back where you can place your order either for a sandwich or one of the hot meals. And then there are tables up front to which you take your meal and eat. So it's kind of an interesting combination of grocery store and cafe in one.
Sounds great. Guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn. Happy eating.
Bye, Lynn.
You too, guys.
Well, stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Last night, I realized that we're eating a lot of things that are pulled together from bits and pieces that we have on hand. Some of the gold that's making this kind of eating work is pan juices. Now, by pan juices, I mean whenever you stew or roast or sauté, you put the pan juices in the refrigerator. Now, once the fat's hardened, you can discard it, and then you can freeze them. Now, you think of them as the classiest bouillon cubes you will ever find. Really intense flavors for instant sauces or broths. So last night, I wanted to do a big bowl of soup. What I had on hand was leftover spicy cabbage, sort of a stew, but I didn't have any broth. Enter those homemade bouillon cubes. Add some water, the cabbage, 5 minutes of simmering, then finish the soup with maybe a little vinegar, and I threw some chopped sweet onion on it for crunch. Total time, maybe 15 minutes if you include ferreting in the freezer. So think pan juices. Don't let a scrap of leftovers get by you. Some smart person a long time ago said that much of the world lives on the kinds of foods that we throw away, and they live well. Food authority and writer Dory Greenspan is one of those consummate pros. She's always testing out something new, be it equipment or foods. She's written on her own, and she's co-authored books with Julia Child, Danielle Blue, and French pastry deity Pierre Hermès. But my favorite book of Dory's is her baking treatise, Baking From My Home to Yours. Hey, Dory, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what are you into now?
Chocolate.
Oh,
chocolate.
Okay.
Actually, I went to, it was fascinating. Valrhona Chocolate did a tasting with their sensory expert. And it was the kind of thing that, you know, we tasted chocolate very carefully. And I realized this is the way so many of us taste chocolate, but we don't think about it until we're really made to do it step by step.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to taste some chocolate with me?
I'd love to.
Okay. I'm tasting a bar of Manjari chocolate, which is actually a favorite of mine, but I won't tell you about it until we do it. There are 7 steps to tasting chocolate, and you thought you just popped it in your mouth. But first, you need to look at it. If it's shiny, then it's been tempered very well, and that's important. Huh. And then you bring it to your nose, and you smell its odor. And this was interesting. At Valrhona, they distinguish between odor and aroma. And I always thought aroma was just a nice way of saying odor, because odor sounds like things are bad.
Right,
but
right.
Odor means the smell that you get when you breathe directly through your nose.
Uh-huh.
And so you breathe in.
Right, and that's the odor.
That's the odor.
Right.
That's the odor. And then you break it, and you get a snap. And again, that crisp snap is a sign of good tempering.
Okay.
And then you put it in your mouth. This is the best part. This is to really assess the texture.
And this is where you let it melt slowly to see the texture?
That's the next step.
Okay.
You let it melt in your mouth by, and I think we've all done this, by pressing the chocolate up against the roof of your mouth with your tongue. And this really just coats your mouth with flavor. And you can chew a little bit because for the next step, you're going to be distinguishing the aromas. And this is the part that I thought was so interesting because there are classes of aromas. There are the volatile aromas, which are fruity and floral, and they come first. And then come the kind of warmer aromas, the roasting aromas and the spice. And finally, the heavier ones, toasted nuts and woods. And this aroma is what you get. We talk about this in wine all the time. The term is retronasally.
Yeah.
It's the aromas that you get from the back of your nose. So that's kind of indirect smell. And then, finally, while you're appreciating the aromas and this chocolate is melting in your mouth, it's so good, that's when you finally taste it. And what's interesting is the two tastes that we talked about were acidity and bitterness. And with most chocolate, you'll find if you do this, the first taste that you get is acidity. And that makes you salivate. And the last taste that you get as you're finishing the chocolate, and it's the most lingering taste, is bitterness, which is actually a positive in chocolate, and it's a very important chocolate flavor.
And that would be true no matter whether it was a bittersweet or something that had more sugar in it, there would still be that note of bitterness.
There should be, because that's really a backbone flavor in chocolate. It's interesting that chocolates are moving the way wines have moved. We tasted chocolates from a single plantation, which would be the, you know, the chocolate equivalent of a single vineyard wine.
Yes, exactly.
We tasted Grand Cru chocolates, and we really got to appreciate it. It's taking time out to really pay attention. Plus, once you finish, guess what? You get to taste again and again and again.
And the Grand Cru chocolates are when you're talking about chocolates from a single mean. Right?
Right.
We're seeing a lot of those.
And it's so interesting because if you start tasting chocolates, then you realize that there's so much that comes into play. You could be tasting a chocolate that's labeled 64% cacao. And that means that the other, I can't do the math, what is it, 36% are milk solids and sugar. And from one 64% chocolate to another, it can be totally different because what's so important about chocolate is the bean, where it comes from, how it's been fermented, how it's been dried, how it's been roasted, how it's been turned into a bar of chocolate. Every step of the way, there's something important that you will taste in that final piece of chocolate.
Now, the chocolate you were just tasting, the name again?
It's Valrhona Mangiari, M-A-N-J-A-R-I.
Okay.
It's a Grand Cru, and I like it because it's spicy, and I'm not sure that that was one of the original terms, but to me it has the flavors of red fruits and spice, and it's almost winey, and it's a chocolate that I love to use in baking.
Sounds delicious. Fascinating, Dory. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Dory Greenspan is author of Baking from My Home to Yours. Now, show off a fine chocolate in Dory's recipe for gooey chocolate cakes. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our weekly attempt to make midweek suppers a little easier. You get a new recipe each week, along with the brilliance of the moment and shopping and technique tips. And best of all, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Oh, and one other thing when you're on the site, we're hatching a plan for a summer wine and food trip to Oregon, the Willamette Valley, and Portland. Come and join us. Space is limited, but you can find information on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, San Francisco's Chinese doyen and brewing up the rare Chinese family teas. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. You know, if you love hot and sour soup or pot stickers or kung pao chicken, you owe a thank you to Cecilia Chang. as Cecilia has been called the grand dame of San Francisco restaurateurs and a pioneer in bringing regional Chinese food to America. When she opened her strikingly elegant Mandarin restaurant in San Francisco in the 1960s, few people, even few local Chinese, had tasted her food from northern China. Well, the Mandarin became a culinary landmark, and Cecilia became a leader in the San Francisco food community. Well, Cecilia's done a cookbook, The Seventh Daughter, My Culinary Journey from Beijing to San Francisco. Cecilia, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Cecilia, let's begin in China. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Shanghai, but when I was about 5 years old, our family moved to the old capital, Beijing. So I was grown up in Beijing and educated in Beijing.
And was food a great focus in your family?
I have, I'm from a very big family. We have 12 children. You probably think about cheaper by dozen.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
We have 9 girls and 3 boys. I'm number 7 daughter.
And hence the name of
the
book.
Family.
Yeah. Yeah. You weren't raised cooking, I gather.
No, when I was when we were little, we are not allowed to go to the kitchen. So I really never cooked in my life until I came to this country.
What took you to San Francisco?
Number 6 sister, she lost her husband, so I came here try to comfort her. Then I met a couple friends from Tokyo on the street in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And so they want me to negotiate for them to open a restaurant. And later they back out and I got stuck. I put a big deposit for them. I didn't know the law in United States. And once you put a deposit, landlord won't return your money. So finally, I decided I have to open a restaurant because I cannot throw the money away. And the first restaurant that was on Polk Street, the first year is very, very tough because we don't have any like egg foo young or chop suey. And the people, they look at the menu, they said, are you sure this is a Chinese restaurant? How come no chop suey? So I said, well, chop suey really is not Chinese food. It's American version of Chinese food. It takes a long time, you know, they get used to that kind of menu. And later, Herb Kahn came to the restaurant.
Now, he was the food writer or writer at that time, right?
That time, he had his own column in Chronicle.
Ah, in the San Francisco Chronicle.
In San Francisco Chronicle. Yeah. And I remember people keep telling me, if he liked your food, then you had it made. Then later, he came with Alexis Marab, the owner of Alex. You know, the most famous restaurant owner.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Alex used to grow up in China. So he told Herb Kahn, he said, Herb, this is a real Chinese food. This is real stuff. And then Herb write in his column and say how much he liked the food. And so all of a sudden, my telephone just keep ringing. And so many people call in, ask for reservations and you know, try to get information, everything.
All right, but this is now, just putting this in perspective, this is somewhere in the early, this is 1960, right?
1960.
Yeah. You open, your restaurant on Polk Street is way outside of Chinatown, right?
That's right.
And then from there, you open a lavish restaurant, a new Mandarin, again, nowhere, really not anywhere near Chinatown, in Ghirardelli Square, which is right on the wharf, and it was a new development then.
Yes.
Your vision of that restaurant, because I remember walking into that restaurant maybe several years after you opened it, I guess, but it didn't look like every Chinese restaurant.
No, it doesn't look like a Chinese restaurant at all. Looks like an old temple. I think it's a really very beautiful restaurant. The kitchen I was very proud of is wall-to-wall stainless steel. And modernized the kitchen, everything. And every night when all the staff left, I'm still doing the clean the kitchen because I'm so proud of that kitchen.
What do you think about the state of Chinese food in the United States today?
I think the best Chinese food right now is in Los Angeles. They have the variety. They have the food from Shanghai, from Taiwan, from Hunan, from Sichuan. Even they have a Muslim food. And also here in San Francisco, too. They are getting a little bit better slowly. I think the Chinese people, especially the restaurant business, they are very conservative. If they make some money, they don't want to make too much changes. I talked to a few restaurant owners here. I said that, you know, you should go back to China and see what they are doing there now. You should make some changes or something. They said, I don't see why, because we make money. So they are very content.
Well, Cecilia, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Cecilia Chang is author of The Seventh Daughter, My Culinary Journey from Beijing to San Francisco. Now, she left us with a favorite Shanghai dish, which she serves for the new year. Find Lion's Head on the website, splendidtable.org. Tea expert Bill Waddington is one of those born teachers. He can take the most esoteric tea and make it intelligible to even a novice. Bill goes to the primary sources, the tea growers in China, India, and other areas, for his tea source shops in St. Paul, Minnesota. And Bill, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be here again, Lynn.
Okay, so you spend a lot of time in tea country.
Mm-hmm.
What for you now is some real discovery?
My favorite discovery, if you will, is when I go to countries of origin where the tea is actually being made, walk the fields, and I run across teas that maybe have a long tradition there and maybe decades or even centuries old, but have never before been seen in the West. I really enjoy that.
Why haven't these teas traveled?
Because, well, number one, sometimes there's geopolitical reasons for it. They haven't gotten out of a given region.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these regions have not been readily accessible to international trade.
So what regions are we talking about?
First tea I'm going to talk about is a tea from China called Dragon Well. And Dragon Well is probably the most common and most famous tea in China.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all grown in an area called West Lake, about a couple hundred miles southwest of Shanghai. And the last time I was in Shanghai, I met a family who's been growing Dragon Well for centuries commercially.
Right.
You know, and most of that tea would be available through the Chinese government because the tea industry was controlled by the communist government for many, many decades.
Mm-hmm.
But about 10 years ago, capitalism started to creep in and people who had been growing tea for their own pleasure for generations started to make it available outside of their local villages. And this is a tea, we call it Wild Mountain Dragon Well. It's probably the most amazing Dragon Well I've ever tasted. And it's literally grown up the mountainside, up in wild mountainous terrain that could never be commercially viable for tea cultivation, but by this one family for themselves and their little local village. And I happened to run across this last year, and it's a type of tea that 10 years ago never would have been seen more than 30 miles away from where it was made.
Now, you've brewed this. You have these white porcelain small cups with lids on them, and then there's like a sawtooth edge.
Smell
Bill,
that first.
This is amazing. This is green. I should explain. This looks like very thick grass, right? It smells like toasted barley and the ocean. And, oh, my goodness. You know how the sea smells at high tide? Wow. That
That's amazing. The last thing, if I were blindfolded, I would never know that was a tea.
Oh, it's a beautiful tea.
Okay, now it's a clear, pale gold liquid.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. It almost has a slight saltiness to it and a toasted quality. Tastes very green, if you know what I mean. It's green tea, but I mean, it tastes fresh. It has that fresh quality to it. But the other part of it is it's very mellow, and it just reminds me of the ocean.
Get a real silky note into it, a textural quality that you don't often get in a green tea.
Yeah, this was almost like a broth.
Mm-hmm.
I could have this before dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could see serving this instead of broth, especially in the cold weather.
This was also the 2007 Shanghai Tea House Competition Dragon Well Grand Prize winner. Very cool tea.
Very cool tea. Now, what's next?
Second one is the oolong, a Tiquanyin oolong, which is a famous type of oolong from Fujian province of China. Again, it's a question of something that a family's been doing for at least three generations,
right,
but has never been available outside of their immediate region before. Now, this kind of an oolong is usually light and sweet and almost floral tasting.
Mm-hmm.
Smell this, Lynn.
Oh, my. That's musky and, again, that toasted quality.
And here's the brood leaf.
Oh, the brood leaf looks like it. You know what it looks like when people shred black corrugated paper?
Okay.
It's all very crinkly. And the aroma, it's almost tobacco-like.
Almost.
And I don't mean that in an unpeeling way.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe it?
In terms of aroma, it's definitely got a toasty aroma to it. I love the color of it. It's black as coal.
Mm.
And this is a light oolong. And what this family does is after the tea has been made, and the last step of making any tea is to heat it gently to kill the enzymes in the leaf so it doesn't mold, they put it away and they store it for a year. And then they take it out, and then they heat it again, that last step called firing. They fire it a second time, and then they put it away and store it for a year. And then they take it out, and they fire the leaves again. And then they put it away and store it. And they've done this for 5 years.
So this is a five-year-old tea?
Five-year-old tea that's been fired successively each of those 5 years.
Can you briefly explain exactly what an oolong is?
An oolong is basically between a green and a black tea. It's not as strong or robust as a black tea. It tends to have more body and a little bit more fullness than a green tea.
This is remarkable. I take my tea with sugar and milk, which I realize probably makes your hair stand on end. But both of these teas are teas that you would drink the way you would drink a great cognac.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a good description.
Wow. I'm bowled over.
Hope you enjoyed them, Lynn.
Thank you. Thank you. So very limited quantity, right?
Oh, very limited quantity in these teas. Very limited quantity. And the Dragon Well, I was only able to buy about 200 pounds. That's all they had left. They make about 250 pounds a year. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the five-year-old Tiquanyin, I was able to buy less than that of that. And it's 5 years old, so I can't go back and buy anymore.
Yeah. It's gone.
It's gone.
Got to wait another 5 years or get the next one.
Exactly.
Bill Waddington, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
Bill Waddington is a tea importer and owner of the Tea Source Shops in St. Paul, Minnesota. Now, you can find information on the new old teas Bill talked about on the website, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It's time for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Rachel on the phone from Gallup, New Mexico. Hey, Rachel, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I have become a habitual ice cream maker, and one of the things that I've been trying to make recently is sort of a winter-themed pumpkin ice cream.
Right, yeah.
And I've had this problem with fruit ice creams in the past where I guess the water content kind of gets in the way, and they get a lot of ice crystals in them. And I'm not really sure how to fix that. I thought if I cooked it down, it might kind of mess up the flavor or texture.
Well, let me think that. Tell me, first of all, how are you making the ice cream?
I'm making a custard base where I use egg yolks. I heat up half and half and add it to the egg yolks
and then
sugar.
You cook it until it's thick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And do you use an ice cream maker?
I do.
All right, because large crystals generally come from two things. Either the mixture is not stone cold when it goes into the machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean stone cold, like it's been in the fridge overnight.
Right.
And or it is moved too slowly. So it's not being mixed quite fast enough to keep breaking down the crystals that form.
Huh.
Now, my thought would be, if you have something that's very watery, now with pumpkin, how are you cooking your pumpkin before you put it in?
Well, I was just kind of making it up. So I was taking the pumpkin out of a can, like the pumpkin puree.
Ah, that has a lot of water in it.
It does.
Yeah. Could I make a suggestion?
Please.
I'm going to add an hour of work to your, well, it's not work, just an hour of waiting and cooling and whatever. And first of all, do you cool the mixture, really take it down?
I'm guilty of being a little impatient.
Okay. That may be the source of your problem right
okay.
there.
Okay.
So maybe just a case of make that custard. And by the way, be sure to take that custard to 170 degrees on an instant reading thermometer.
Okay.
Because that way the eggs are cooked through for safety's sake, but also for another reason. Even though it's a frozen dessert, if the eggs are not fully cooked, it changes in consistency.
Okay.
Okay. But at any rate, the point is, first of all, chill it overnight. Just play it safe. I'll bet you that may solve the problem. But the other thing is that if you choose a really dense squash like butternut or kombucha,
mm-hmm.
and it's quite sweet also, and you bake it. So you cut the squash in half, take out the seeds. I just put a piece of aluminum foil over a cookie sheet, lightly oil it, put the thing cut side down, put it in a 400-degree oven about an hour or until I can take a knife and just slip it in. You know, there's almost no resistance.
Okay.
Now, the two things happen. You kind of concentrate the moisture, but you also concentrate the flavor. It's richer, mm-hmm. richer tasting. Pumpkin itself, unless it's sugar pumpkin, generally is pretty bland.
Mm-hmm.
So cool that down, chill it completely, and then just use that instead of the canned pumpkin.
Great.
Okay. But first and foremost, chill it completely. And I think you won't have a problem.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Take
Bye.
Care. Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, it's about egg anatomy. What is the curly, white, knobby thing right next to the yolk? And what should you do with it? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was about egg anatomy, and it was, what is the curly, white, knobby thing right next to the yolk, and what should you do with it? Well, it's called the chalaze, and there are two of them in each egg, and they're like bungee cords. They're like bungee cords of protein that connect the membrane around the yolk to the inside of the shell. Now, when we crack the egg, the cords snap into tight little wads, hence the curly appearance. Now, the bigger the chalaze, the fresher the egg. So don't remove it. It's just more protein. So cook it right along with the rest of the egg. Well, you know, I can't leave chicken trivia alone. I mean, do you know that it takes a chicken 24 to 26 hours to create a single egg? And then she only gets 30 minutes off before she has to start the process all over again. And one more thing. Rookie hens lay little eggs, and as the hen matures, her eggs get bigger. And one very last thing. The rooster is not necessary for a hen to lay eggs. She does that automatically. But if you want a fertile egg, as in you want chicks, then the rooster steps into the picture. And now I will stop. Let's get back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who has been waiting patiently. We have got Kai calling from Louisville. Kai, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, it's Kai. First of all, Louisville loves you. Oh. We all love you here.
Thank you, sir. That's good to know.
And I'm a hairdresser here in Louisville, and of course, every client that comes in, everybody's talking about food. How do you make your this and how do you make your that? And it came up during a discussion, oh, maybe a week before Christmas. One of my clients was asking about dumplings. And, you know, dumplings, there lots of people make them different ways. And I was listening to your show like the very next day, and I thought, wait a minute, I wonder how Lynn makes her dumplings. So I'm wondering if you have a recipe that you use for dumplings.
Oh,
I'm from the South, so traditionally I grew up with it being served as chicken and dumplings.
All right, because I'm going to throw the question back at you in a minute. And I have a confession to make. I have not made dumplings in ages, but mm-hmm. just hearing that word.
Sure.
I am ready. Talk about the weather for dumplings. Oh, this
exactly.
is, I'll tell you what I know about dumplings and what I remember from, you know, there's a million ways of doing them.
Sure.
To me, the Eastern European dumplings, the bread dumplings and that kind of thing you find in Austria and places like that, I have never conquered those. Mine are always like lead sinkers. But basically, American-style dumplings are like a biscuit dough, but you drop it in a simmering, delicious stew, and you let it cook maybe about 10 minutes or so. But it's a well-made biscuit dough. But that said, it can have any kind of flavoring going. I mean, I can never resist. I mean, if you're doing, well, chicken and dumplings, wouldn't it be great to have scallions and fresh herbs in that?
Oh, it sounds incredible, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you think, okay, what's a typical biscuit recipe? Off the top of my head, because I used to make these all the time, 2 cups of flour, 2 teaspoons of baking powder, a little baking soda if you're throwing buttermilk in, maybe 1/2 to 3/4 cups of milk, and I'm not doing this in the order you would normally put it together.
Sure, sure.
You know that because you're from biscuit country.
I am.
You really are. But probably anywhere from 1/4 to 1/2 cup of some kind of good tasting fat.
Oh, yes. It sounds wonderful. My mother traditionally, when she would make dumplings, she would just use the broth. She would get a hen that had a good amount of fat on it and boil it. And then she would just use the drippings from the hen that she had cooked with to mix with an all-purpose flour. She would roll those out into like a pie crust and cut them into thin strips and then maybe cut them into like maybe 1.5 to 2-inch strips. And then she'd drop them into boiling stock that she had cooked the hen in. And when they, you know, like you said, they didn't take very long to cook and she'd take them right out. And then afterwards, she'd take the meat off the chicken, put it in a platter, and the dumplings would just go right on top. And
so
salt and pepper to taste, but it was very simple and very easy. But I like the idea of the herbs and the
But she put no leavening in it then, you're saying.
So no leavening at all.
So it was almost like a cross. So it was flour and the wonderful fat from the chicken, which has my mouth watering.
And she said you had to have the fat in the cooking droppings or it wouldn't be as flavorful.
Well, she's absolutely right. You keep giving, you know, this is basic premise. It sounds like, you know, you're standing on a platform preaching. To me, you always give back to a dish its own flavors. Like the idea of basting a roast with its own pan juices.
Yes.
But because it's the fat that's from the chicken or it's the juices from the meat, they change, they intensify, they magnify. And as you put them back into the dish, they bring out another dimension of what the dish is about. But I've got to try your mom's way. I mean, it almost sounds like a noodle. But
exactly. And she rolls them pretty thin, so they cook relatively quickly.
Did she
and,
handle
you know, I listened to your show, you know, religiously, and I've heard you mention growing up, you know, in your family. And I think there's something about those informative years. Nothing tastes the same as when you're, you know, 6 to 10 years old. There's nothing like mom's chicken and dumplings. Even though I try to imitate it, it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
But I'm going to try with the herbs and the scallions because that's more in tune with the way I cook.
I've got to try your mom's.
All right.
Hey, Kai, thank you.
Hey, Lynn, thanks a lot. Love your show.
You take care.
Bye-bye. You as
thank
well.
Thank you. Bye. That is the best idea. The fat from the really good hen. Gently mix it with the flour, roll it out thin, and drop it into the broth. Wow. Okay. You can reach us 800-537-5252. We have Jeremy on the line from Iowa City. Jeremy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I wanted to talk about freezing bread dough.
Okay.
I have this really nice sourdough starter that I use to make loaves and dinner rolls, but that requires a little bit of forethought and planning ahead, and I don't always do that. And so the other, I guess it was probably about last week, we bought one of those packets of, I think the brand was Alexi, those dinner rolls that you take out, you can throw them in the oven for 15 minutes.
They're really baked.
Right.
And you're defrosting them essentially in the oven and getting them crisp.
Right. So I was wondering if there's a way to do that with my sourdough recipe, if there's a way that I can basically have some rolls ready to go in the freezer and then bring them out and bake them. And if that is possible, what do I need to do in terms of modifying the recipe or adjusting bake times or letting dough thaw or anything like that?
This is my concern. There's no question that you can bake your bread, have it in the freezer and take it out and bake it.
Mm-hmm.
That is to heat it through.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think far enough ahead, you could take it out. And this is one of the few foods you can defrost on the counter. Just take it out, let it sit on the counter for an hour or, you know, even take it out in the morning and have it in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality, although it might dry out a bit, you know, the thing with freezing is it tends to suck moisture from things.
Right.
But still, freezing baked bread, easy to do, very successful. It doesn't suffer. And then you can warm it in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
My concern about doing that with a risen loaf that is unbaked is that by the time you get the entire thing, let's say, defrosted,
mm-hmm.
the exterior part of the dough is going to be completely overrisen and it'll be it really will be a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
If you put it into the oven frozen, it's going to be the same problem. It's going to bake at all these different rates,
right.
And you're not going to get a good result. But I would bake your bread when you have the time, put it in small packages,
mm-hmm.
and then just warm them up. They'll be fabulous.
Okay.
And there's a trick. There's an old trick. My Italian grandmother did it, and then I discovered everybody's grandmother, I guess, did it. But anyway, she used to take bread that had dried out a bit but was not stale.
Mm-hmm.
And what she would do is she would just lightly wet her hand and run it over the surface of the loaf,
uh-huh.
lightly wrap it in something like foil and put it in the oven. And when it was hot all the way through, she'd open the foil and give it another few minutes and it would crisp.
Okay.
Now, you had to eat it fairly soon because mm-hmm. if you let it sit, it would just dry out. But it was fabulous. But mm-hmm. I think bake it and freeze it and you'll be fine.
Okay. And how long will that keep in the freezer?
6 months.
6 months, okay.
Would you believe 6 months? So you've got prime, just wrap it really well, no air in the package, heavy duty wrapping, you know, maybe one of those bags, the heavy duty plastic bags, but push out all of the possible air
mm-hmm.
and you'll be in good shape.
Excellent.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us 800-537-5252. We have Marcia calling from Indianapolis. Marcia, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I've got a question for you about sangria. I grew up in Florida, and we used to go over to Tampa to the Cuban restaurants there and
mm-hmm.
have such wonderful Cuban food. And as we grew up, we were able to get pitchers of sangria. So now I've got recipes for sangria, and it calls for Spanish red wine. And I've never known what kind of Spanish red wine to use. So
you got a big choice.
I was hoping you could help me with that. I've tried to find out along the way. I went to a wine tasting one time when
mm-hmm.
they had some representatives from the different vineyards in Spain. And I went up to some of the representatives and asked them what kind of wine, and I'm afraid I didn't realize I was insulting them because, of course, their wine was so good it would never be mixed with fruit juice. So,
yeah.
So I really didn't mean to insult them, but I guess I did.
I've done similar things. Yeah. It's and then you suddenly realize, oh, dear.
Yeah.
I didn't intend that.
Yeah.
Generally, you want not a super heavy-bodied wine, and needless to say, it doesn't have to be expensive, but drinkable. Tempranillo is one to look for. They're usually modestly priced. They're good drinking, but Tempranillo would be one.
Mm-hmm.
Grenache.
Grenache.
Yeah, which is a grape, but often the label actually says Grenache. And it's, as I recall, it is a grape that's also used in the Rhone Valley in France. And that, again, is a fruity. It's like the Tempranillo. They tend to be fruity. They tend to be a little bit lighter bodied. They're not big bruisers of wine. So those two would be easy to find. They're not going to be wildly expensive, and they'd be great for making a sangria.
Oh, I am so excited to try these recipes with one of those.
Yeah, just don't tell any Spanish wine expert that you think their wines are wonderful, you know, for sangria. Because they'll get a little touchy.
I think so.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. You know, when it comes to choosing a restaurant, the web's opened up a ton of possibilities. And therein lies the rub. Because you bounce from site to blog to site. Well, Urban Spoon is a site that is trying to bring all of that together for a flock of cities across the country. Urban Spoon's Ethan Lowry is on the phone. Ethan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us on the show.
So what kind of information can I find on the site?
Well, Urban Spoon's idea really is to try to bring together, like you said, all those voices from across the web. So the first thing you find when you're looking for a restaurant is the information from the local restaurant reviewers at your newspaper, magazines, food bloggers in your town, and fellow food lovers in your town.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to bring all that stuff together onto the one page. So if you set about looking for a restaurant, let's say that you want to find a restaurant in your neighborhood, or you want to find a restaurant of a certain type of food, you do a search on Urban Spoon, you find the restaurant, and it kind of lays all that out for you. So you get to find the basics, the phone number, the address, all that stuff, as well as the menu, and maybe most importantly, what all those opinions that you care about are in
one
place.
Yeah. How many cities do you do?
We're currently about 30 cities across the U.S. and Canada.
Huh. Now, on each site, I notice that you've got a list of the top 10 restaurants in that area. Now, are these the top 10 from professional critics or top 10 from diners' comments?
Those are actually from diners' comments. So what we do, we have a system on the site where people can vote without having to register or sign in or do anything like that. You can basically click a simple, I like it or I don't, for any restaurant. And
mm-hmm.
We kind of tally the results from all that, and you can see then that maybe you go to a restaurant, you'll find that 100 people have voted and 80% of them like the restaurant. And we use that user-generated voting to determine what are the top restaurants in your town.
I see. Okay. Now, is there any way I can do a really fast scan to see a tally of the pros and cons of a particular place?
Well, yeah. If you look at a page for a restaurant, you're going to see at the top of it that percentage. You get to see that the fastest scan is really what do your fellow diners have to say about the restaurant. And then you read down, and the first thing you run into are what your local newspapers have to say, and then you'll see what your local food bloggers have to say. And then there at the bottom, you can read through what a bunch of fellow diners have to say. So really, you're only having to – we show just the first little bit of the review. If you want to read the full text, you can link off and read on the newspaper's own site what they have to say. But it gives you a pretty quick rundown of what the opinions are that are out there about the restaurant.
So do the local picks, the people's picks – usually match up with the professional reviewers' picks?
I think they surprisingly do. If you look at it from a sort of statistical perspective, once you've got 100 people voting on the restaurant, I think you start to get a pretty accurate read on what the general consensus is of a restaurant. And I'm surprised that it usually lines up pretty closely with what the pros have to say on it. That said, there's always those gems. The professionals tend to focus in on, I don't know, those $3 and $4 sign, fine dining restaurants.
Yeah, yeah.
The regular people tend to find those maybe lower end, but
half dollar sign places.
Exactly.
Yes,
those
yes.
Are my favorite.
So where are you going next with this? Taking it to Europe, maybe?
Actually, yeah. When we expanded to Canada, we were excited that we could finally call ourselves an international company. It's just the three of us. So our next step is to go intercontinental. I think we'll be adding London and Sydney. We focus mostly on English language cities so far, just for convenience. But God, there's so much great eating in Europe, and we'll have to go.
But there's great eating everywhere.
It's so true. But this is the funny thing. I mean, you think about the classic conception of what American food is fast food and McDonald's. But as we're finding, we're in cities like St. Louis and Cleveland that you might not traditionally think of as big foodie towns, and we're seeing that these are actually thriving food communities. I mean, there's great new restaurants opening up all the time, and dozens of bloggers, hundreds of bloggers, really, that are out there, you know, writing about it. And you can see that the community is really alive and well for great food.
It's not on both coasts anymore. Hey, Ethan, thanks.
Thank you.
Ethan Lowry is one of the creators of Urban Spoon. Now, for more information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime, day or night. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Brian Miller, former restaurant critic for the New York Times. He said, "The quality of food is in inverse proportion to the dining room's altitude, especially atop bank and hotel buildings." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, information about everything you heard here today, and I mean that, can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. You're going to find many opportunities there, podcasts, field trips, newsletters, and many of the recipes you heard here today. Our show is produced by Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.